American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
American Timelines by History for Jokes, the greatest podcast ever.
Somehow I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down, like blues on Tuesdays come down. Throw it all up.
One and a two and a...
Welcome to another episode of American Timelines. I'm Amy.
And I am a half-eaten bag of Funyuns that have been animated by a magical wizard from another realm.
Okay.
And so I've come to life, and now you can all hear what it's like to speak to a half-eaten bag of Funyuns.
Okay, that's Joe.
I'm Joe.
This is the... podcast that brings you all the crazy, fascinating events from pop culture history.
Crazy stories that you won't believe happened.
And we do it year by year.
And we cover crazy music songs that were the top songs. You won't believe sometimes what the songs were.
Yep.
And Amy's going to tell you a crazy crime story or a murder or an abduction. And then we'll do what we call crime lines. We'll tell you what was going on during those murders to kind of put you in there.
You're bringing in the crime lines.
Crime lines, y'all.
That's Ryan Burkett.
Copywritten by Ryan Burkett. But no, it's a crime line is a thing. And so it puts you, I've had people tell me like, oh, I now know when that murder happened because I remember that episode of Sanford and Son.
Thank God for them that they listened to this podcast and that happened.
Yeah, it did. A lot of people stopped me on the street like, hey, keep up the crime lines, bro.
Okay.
And some people like the sports that we talk about. Some people like the songs. Some people get upset when we hate songs and they mail us hate letters.
All right, where did we leave off?
We left off. This is episode 41, so thank you for listening. We're doing this enough so that we like doing this enough that we have 41 episodes. This will be our 41st episode under our belt.
It's pretty sweet.
Well, not a lot of podcasts make it.
Someday
past
I'm
going
to go back and listen to the first one.
Oh, I hesitate to. It's got to be terrible. We didn't even do anything then. Like, we didn't even research anything. Like, we just read off the internet.
I know.
a guy at work, a bartender I know, told me that he listened to it, and he thought it was pretty good. And I was like, oh, it gets way better. That sucked.
Yeah, no
and
kidding.
He liked it, but I was like, oh, well, but he doesn't know about podcasts. But anyway, we're in 1975. We left off in... I think in March, the end of March of 1975.
Okay.
But we're going to bring you back into the spring of 75 when everybody had giant sideburns filled with cocaine.
Giant sunglasses.
And giant sunglasses. And
hats.
Every commercial was for Marlboro everywhere. Everybody smoked cigarettes.
Marlboro or Anison.
Yeah, Anison. And everybody smelled bad. And nobody showered.
I think
everybody
they showered.
Everybody had dirty hair.
No, I'm
soap didn't
going
work.
A little far, I think.
No, I don't know. It's just like what I remember.
You were living on the Lark side.
Of course, I wasn't born yet. Hey, you don't have to disparage the Lark side. I wasn't born yet still. We're still 75. We're still a year before I was born. But we got to go quick because we got a lot of stuff to cover.
Yep.
And if we want to get through 75 in these episodes, we got to just jump right in. So
all right.
I'm going to jump right into April 5th. Which with the number one song on the Billboard charts by Minnie Riperton.
Okay.
Do you know who Minnie Riperton is? Do you remember that name?
Faintly.
You'll remember it when I play this for you.
Oh, yeah. The South Park song.
Loving you is easy because you're beautiful. A lot of people remember that from the Big Gay Al episode on South Park. That's what we mostly know it for, where they would... I thought it was the Brown Note. Wasn't that the Brown Note episode
that's
where
what
make
I
people poop their
it was.
Pants?
Yeah.
I found something online that said it's supposed to make people explode or something. I thought it was poop their pants, but I could be remembering
it
wrong.
I didn't remember what the episode was about at all. I just remember seeing it on there.
Yeah, I think according to Wikipedia, it is the Big Gay Al episode, which we loved.
Loved, yeah.
And our friend Brian McCartney was Big Gay Al for Halloween.
That's right.
It was probably his best Halloween costume.
It was hysterical,
And so That makes two friends of ours that look just like South Park characters when they want to.
Who's the other one?
The chef. Our buddy D. Jones. D. Jones was the chef 1 year
That's
in college,
right.
And he won every contest. And he just put on a red shirt, and he already had a big beard. And
the chef's hat.
And wore a chef's hat. And everywhere he went, he won. Everybody just like, oh, forget it. He's
yeah.
a winner.
That's pretty good.
The best costume ever. Anyway, I don't think I ever even heard of that song until that South Park episode.
Yeah, I don't know if I had either.
But it was produced by Stevie Wonder and Richard Rudolph.
Okay.
And it was, there's really not much else to say about that song. But
all right.
I think people loved it in the 70s.
Yeah, I think they did. All right, what else?
It's like one of those songs that would be perfect while somebody's doing a whole line of coke and then murdering somebody like that's in the background. It'd be awesome for a movie.
What?
Well, you're the one who loves murder. So then Tuesday, April 8th, that same week, the 47th Annual Academy Awards were presented.
Okay.
At the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles, California. The ceremonies were presided over by...
What 18 washed-up actors were there?
It was four people. You want to guess?
Liza Minnelli.
Nope.
Oh.
Shirley MacLaine.
Well, I thought you wanted me to guess.
Well, you got the woman wrong. The other three are dudes.
Are dudes?
Are dudes.
Oh.
And two of them are in the Rat Pack.
Tony Bennett?
Nope.
Sammy Davis Jr.?
Yep.
And Frank Sinatra?
I got chunks of guys like you in my stool.
Ooh, all right.
Frank Sinatra.
And
then the other one is a comedian known for doing bits in front of troops.
Oh, Bob Hope.
Bob Hope.
Okay.
Bob
yeah.
Hope. Bob Hope, Shirley MacLaine, Sammy Davis Jr., and Frank Sinatra. This was the last year that NBC aired the ceremonies before ABC secured broadcasting rights, which they still hold to this day.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
The big deal on this year was, again, a Godfather thing. The Godfather Part II received twice as many Oscars as its predecessor, which is six, and it duplicated its feat of three Best Supporting Actor nominations as of the 90th Academy Awards, the last film to receive three nominations in a single acting category.
Okay.
And, some other stuff. This was the only Oscars where all nominees in one category were released by the same studio. All five Best Costume Design nominations were for films released by Paramount Pictures.
Oh, okay.
And this is the whole thing where it wraps up. Don Vito Corleone is the only fictional character to have received more than one Oscar for its portrayal. Remember Marlon? We talked about this in 1973.
Right.
Marlon Brando and 1975 by Robert De Niro as a young Vito.
That's right.
And then both actors never bothered to attend the ceremony. And Brando actually rejected the award. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, good. You remember. Cool. So you're not all the way.
I knew that already. Remember? That
oh,
was
you
something
knew
I already
before?
Had known. Yeah.
Oh. Well.
So there you
congratulations,
go.
Congratulations,
you
know-it-all of the Oscars.
I accept your apology.
Yeah, and there was no streaker at this Oscars, unfortunately.
No.
But it was the 47th annual. 47th, pretty cool number.
God.
That was my lucky number.
Because you were a high school football 47 is why.
High school football number 47.
The biggest Al Bundy loser.
I still am a loser.
You are Al Bundy.
Care about it, yeah.
All right, what's
next? It was fun. It was an accomplishment. My body is wrecked because of it. Saturday, April 12th, 1975, Elton John takes over the Billboard number one spot.
With,
this is the song you thought the other one was.
Philadelphia Freedom.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you know about this song?
Not much.
It was written by Elton John and Bernie Taupin as a favor to John's friend, tennis star, Billie Jean King.
Is that what it was about?
Well, Billie Jean King was part of the Philadelphia Freedom's professional tennis team.
Oh.
The song features an orchestral arrangement by Gene Page, including flutes, horns, and strings.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of this song.
Elton, because of Billie Jean King?
No, there's a lot of Elton John. I just don't get it. Like Benny and the Jets
and
Crocodile Rock, which is an awful song. Like there's certain Elton John, I just don't get it.
You're going to piss a lot of people off. I love Benny and the Jets, and I think this one's pretty good. Elton John met Billie Jean King in 1973.
I mean, there's songs I really like. Like I love the song Daniel, and I love this.
You mean Ben?
No.
According to reporters for CNN, they have since built a powerful partnership in philanthropy, raising hundreds of millions of dollars for equal rights and for HIV AIDS causes. So,
okay.
Because you hate this, you hate HIV and AIDS causes.
All right.
anyway, so Elton John really liked Billie Jean King and wrote the lyrics to what would become Philadelphia Freedom, dedicated to her because of her team. And at the time, King had just been ranked the world's number one women's player for the fifth time in the previous 7 years.
Sweet.
And the whole battle of the sexes thing happened. I did have feedback from somebody who was a young person around this time. They said they remember the battle of the sexes. It was like a big deal. Everybody was talking about it everywhere. But it was not real. Like, it wasn't a real competition. They were just like playing together. Like, they were just doing it for fun. Like, just kind
of. They did?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was.
It wasn't like a cutthroat game. Like, it was like a charity game. Like, they're just messing around. But it was, everybody talked about it. It was like unprecedented at the time.
Okay.
And then on Saturday, April 26th, we got a new number one song on the Billboard charts.
Okay.
BJ Thomas.
We already did Raindrops Are Falling on My Head, right?
Yeah, and this one I don't think I had ever heard of. Do you know this song?
Yeah. Hey, won't you play another somebody done somebody wrong song? I kind of like this song.
You do?
Yeah, a little bit. I think it's because it reminds me of being little. Like, it's not, I'm not thinking of it in a purely artistic way. It just, it reminds me of being a little kid.
It's a nostalgic song.
And so it's nostalgic to me, yeah. It's hard to separate that out, I think, sometimes.
Are you crying?
No.
Oh, BJ Thomas is only, the only thing he ever did good was the Growing Pains theme song. So.
All right.
Which you refuse to admit you're wrong about.
I thought we were talking about the Golden Girls theme song. That's what you said.
No, that was Andrew Gold. That's what I thought it was originally, then I remembered. It was Growing Pains.
All right, we're not rehashing our life.
Anyway,
here.
this song by BJ Thomas,
yeah.
In 1976, it was performed by the Muppets on The Muppet Show.
It was?
Yeah.
That song?
Yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. Like, what, you know, sometimes they did like melancholy type stuff.
Yeah.
And then on May 3rd, 1975, Tony Orlando and Dawn.
Oh, Jesus.
Are back again.
What is it?
And they take over the Billboard charts with...
What did they
he
sing
don't
last time?
Love You.
Oh, If He Don't Love You Like I Love You. That one? If he did, he wouldn't break your heart.
Yeah, that sounds like it's right. Yeah, Tony Orlando and Dawn. And I didn't realize that Dawn wasn't a person. I thought it was two people. I thought so too. I thought like Tony Orlando and some woman
named
Dawn.
Dawn.
Yeah, no. Dawn is like the name of the group. It's Dawn. Like, like Dusk Dawn. Yeah, so it's just Tony Orlando, this guy with a mustache, and this group of ladies who are... Oh, it's...
I didn't know that. You just blew my mind.
No, and remember what I talked about at one point,
and
I mentioned...
Dawn was a chick.
One of the singers was Thelma Hopkins, who was on...
Yeah.
Give Me a Break.
Oh, okay.
So in the video, you can see... It's a terrible video, but...
you can see her.
But she's in there in the backup. She's one of the singers for Dawn. Is that the song you thought
yep.
it was? So anyway, there's that. Yeah, so Dawn is not a woman. It's a group
of
people.
Oh, my God.
I just blew your mind, huh?
Yeah,
you didn't know that either.
I bet a lot of people think that.
Well, it took me a while to get that. Too through my head and reading about it, I was like, mm-hmm. "Oh, Dawn's not a person." It's like, why doesn't she have a last? Or, you know, Tony Orlando and Dawn, or why is not Tony and Dawn Orlando? Or
whatever. Right.
Yeah. So anyway, when Tony Orlando and the other members of Dawn were mm-hmm. waiting in the lobby to go on at a Golden Globes award ceremony, Orlando spoke with Faye Dunaway and her then husband, Peter Wolfe, lead singer of the Jay Giles Band.
What?
Yeah.
Faye Dunaway was married to
yes.
the lead singer of the J. Giles
Band?
Doesn't
that blow your mind?
Yes.
So I immediately had to stop what I was doing and Google those two
yeah.
names together to see them together.
Yeah.
And it's weird. Like,
is it?
Yeah. Like, she's Faye Dunaway and he's
yeah.
J. Giles guy. Like, but they were married. Yeah. So anyway, while they were to pass the time before going on, the two began singing. Faye Dunaway and Tony Orlando began singing various R&B songs from the 60s, including Butler's He Will Break Your Heart, which the couple recommended that the group record on an upcoming album, and Orlando contacted Mayfield requesting permission to do a remake, but to change the song's title to the opening lines He Don't Love You. And Mayfield gave us permission. So this is really just a remake, but they changed some of the words.
Okay.
So there you go. And and because he was talking to Faye Dunaway, who was married to
the Jay Giles band guy.
Yeah, which...
Like, most of that, yeah, I didn't even follow.
Care about.
But
well, they were talking. They came up with the idea for the song while he's talking to Faye Dunaway, good ready for the Golden Globes.
Right.
But she was sitting there with her Jay Giles band guy, Peter Wolf.
Okay.
That's crazy. I did not know he was married to her. That's nuts. Sunday, May 4th, 1975, the very next day, right after that song became the number one song in the Billboard charts, Mo Howard died.
Oh, he did.
Remember earlier in the year we talked about Larry Fine died.
Okay.
Mo died of lung cancer at age 77 on May 4th, 1975 at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles, where he had been admitted a week earlier.
I wonder how long they performed for and like what they did after they were done. Did they go to one of those nursing homes for washed-up stars?
That's the story I told you last time. That's why we talked about that. Larry was at a nursing home for stars.
Oh, right. That's what we talked about.
So, and Mo would go visit him. And Mo was okay, but they had just signed on.
Brothers in real life, right?
No, not Larry. Larry was not a brother. Mo, Curly, and Shemp were brothers.
You sure Curly was?
Yeah, Mo and Curly and Shemp were brothers.
Okay.
Howard, they're the Howard.
Oh,
brothers.
Right. Okay.
And Larry was their friend, so I love the Three Stooges. But they remember I said they were doing a new show.
Yeah.
Like in the '70s, called Kooks, and you can find it on YouTube,
right.
And it's like color, but it's like a whole different show. Which I'm sure they're just slapping the shit out of each other, though.
Yeah.
But then Larry had a stroke and he got sick and whatever. So
I wonder how many
Mo
times they really injured each other doing that.
Oh, they had to really hurt each other and had brain damage and stuff. But anyway, Mo was a heavy smoker for much of his adult life.
Can you picture that? Like
Mo
the guy
smoking?
Who plays Mo sitting there smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, I mean, he always looked like a smoker. Like his
but,
face.
But
was
like
all...
having him not act like a stooge, just being like regular. I can't picture it.
Yeah.
So you know, we didn't have the access to stars being themselves back then. Like he's not
stuff.
In talk shows.
But you can find,
and stuff
yeah,
like
he
that.
Was actually. You can find
was
on
he
YouTube.
Really?
Like he had white hair, and when he's older, and he was on a couple. Talk shows. I've seen those. Just because for me, it's fascinating to see the Stooges not being Stooges because they're always just
right.
Stooges.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, there's some videos on YouTube of him on different shows and stuff in the 70s.
Oh, really?
But here's the sad thing about this. Well, I mean, not that it's all sad because Mo's dead, but his wife, Helen Schoenberger, died of a heart attack later that year. And I think she probably died of a broken heart.
Okay.
Yeah, because Mo's dead.
Right. All right.
At the time of his death, Mo was working on his autobiography titled I Stooge to Conquer. It was released in 1977 as Mo Howard and the Three Stooges, which I am now going to...
Want to get that?
I want to read that.
His autobiography?
Yeah. I know everything about the Stooges.
I never knew that about you.
Well, you know how my great uncle's dad was Hans Hall. We were going with the Bowery Boys, and he was good friends with Shemp.
Oh, with
Shemp Howard.
Okay.
Yeah, Shemp and Hans Hall were buddies, and so I've heard some stories like that, which is just, to me, it's fascinating that anybody knows Shemp personally. Like, I know someone who knows Shemp personally. Like,
well, you don't know
it's like
Hans
a different
Hall.
World. I met him.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Well,
met him once.
Okay. You're really reaching the stars. You get your feet on the ground and you're reaching up for those
stars.
Well,
he's my uncle's uncle. He's my uncle's father. Like, he knows him really well. So just hearing him tell stories of Shemp being at their house and stuff.
Yeah.
I also have a guy I work with who grew up in Vegas and stuff, and his dad would play cards with Red Fox.
Oh, really?
So when he was a kid, Red Fox would be over playing poker in the kitchen while he was a kid running around. And Jack Sue from Barney Miller.
Oh,
like,
was
so
he there
cool.
too?
I guess. He just was a little kid walking around. Jack Sue was in his house.
Yeah.
And Red Fox is so cool. Anyway, that kind of stuff is cool. Like, it's more cool to me them just being regular people playing cards and sitting around doing whatever than, like, anything else. I don't know.
Yeah.
Never mind. Pipe down. I apologize. And then after Mo died the next week, Saturday, May 10th, Betamax was released.
Betamax.
Remember Betamax?
Yes, I do.
For you millennials, this is a consumer-level analog recording and cassette format of magnetic tape for video. So think VHS, but smaller.
I thought they were big.
No, they
were
littler.
Like laser disc size.
No, no. It looked just like a VHS, but it was smaller.
Oh, okay.
And it should have probably won, but and a lot of times, I remember there's people that thought, oh, Betamax is going to go. That's going to win.
That's going to be the one.
Go away, and VHS.
I wonder why.
Yeah.
What the bonus was. Like, I never had a Betamax, so I have no idea how it even works.
It's just like a VCR tape. It's the exact same thing, smaller version. It's just like VCRs like this, Beta was like that, you know. And they came out
and then
around
the
same time.
When you went to the video store, it was like there was the Beta section and the VHS section.
I think so.
Yeah.
They were? You remember that?
I do remember that.
I remember somebody down the street, they had a Betamax.
Yeah.
And they would record stuff on Betamax, and they only had, you know, Betamax, and they were like, "Oh, this is the way to go." And
but
I remember
they weren't interchangeable at all.
No, they weren't. But it was like Coke and Pepsi, but it was like they were competing with each other, which was going to take over, and one was going to become the next media.
Yeah,
and
it was
Betamax
VHS.
Lost. But I remember everybody thought Betamax would win. At least I thought that anyway.
Yeah.
VHS.
It
and Betamax.
Became a joke.
Yeah, then it became a joke. Remember Betamax? Oh, you got that on Betamax?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I had this Betamax to sell you.
That's right.
Yeah, Betamax. And then, but I've asked people I work with who are millennials.
Because
I like to just test them. Like, I want to, like, what do millennials know? They have no idea what it is. They don't know what Betamax is.
Oh, I'm sure not.
Yeah, I guess why would they? Why would they?
Yeah.
I'm not judging them. Like, my kids wouldn't know, but why would they know what it is?
There's a lot of people that want to know what Betamax is.
I know what it is.
Well, yeah, because you're an old fuck.
Hey, I sleep with a Betamax.
With your wiener stuck in one.
Well, you don't have to tell everyone.
Well, you had to.
I'll get off eventually. I'll get it off of there.
Finally bring that out.
And then on Tuesday, May 13th, 1975, Jake the Snake Roberts made his wrestling debut.
Oh, Jesus.
The son of Blackjack Mulligan, Jake the Snake Roberts. You know the guy who carried a snake to the ring and he'd knock people out, then he'd DDT him, and then he put a snake on him.
He's that old?
Yeah, he made his debut, so he was a young guy, and he wasn't
right.
The snake yet. He was just like a guy with long pants, and he was real
all
tall
right.
With a mustache. But Jake the Snake, his thing is that he's not built at all. Like, he doesn't work out or have any muscles. He just does all kinds of meth.
What?
Yeah.
That's his thing?
Yeah.
He said this is his thing.
Like, his whole thing was like, you know, most wrestlers are all built
right.
and beefy. Like,
I know that, yeah.
He didn't have any muscles at all. He's just a tall guy, and then he did tons of drugs. And like went off the deep end and somehow was nuts. And there's a documentary on Netflix about him.
Oh my God.
Jake the Snake Roberts being just like fucked up. Like, his whole family doesn't talk to him, and he's just like,
oh, that's bizarre.
On meth. But DDP saved the day with DDP Yoga. Diamond Dallas Page saved him.
Oh my God.
It's a great Netflix documentary.
All right, what's next?
What? Why are you upset? It's a great feel good story. Jake the Snake's good now. He's good with his family and everything. And he stopped doing meth. Saturday, May 24th, 1975, Earth, Wind, and Fire take over the Billboard number one spot.
Is it Shining Star?
Yes, it is. Can you see the screen? Is that why you said that?
No.
Can you see my, okay.
No.
Shining Star, yeah.
I'm a shining star, no matter who you are, shining bright to see what you can truly be.
The concept for the song came to Maurice White. While strolling at night during the band's recording of That's the Way of the World, he was inspired by looking up at the starry sky and took his ideas about the song to the other band members. And they all said, that's stupid. But he did it anyway.
No, they did not.
They might have.
You're making some shit up.
Anyway, the song is noted for the way the instruments drop out during the last repeated choruses, with the group singing the final lines a cappella, followed by the song's abrupt end. You remember that? You love that song?
Yeah. I do know the end.
You love it, though? Is it your favorite?
It's a nice disco tune.
Is it your favorite?
It's not my favorite,
Is it the only thing you listen to every day?
No.
Oh, okay. Do you like anybody on this podcast more than a friend?
Would you please move on?
Just wonder, is there anybody in the podcast that you kind of like? You know, you like
All
to
right.
see outside of the
I'm
podcast?
I'm not going to dignify that with an answer.
Okay, well, just... Let me know if you ever feel that way. I'll just
okay. For some, the bad thing is I knew you were going to say that. That's the worst part of it all.
But you still laughed.
I know, because I knew you were going to say that.
Oh, that you weren't laughing because it was funny. You laughed because I was going
to
say it.
Well, because you're so predictable.
What?
That I knew you were going
to
say.
You know,
that.
I'm predictable to you because you've been married to me for 46 years.
Okay, what is the next
May 31st, 1975. This is all just songs this year, apparently. There's a lot of songs to get to. So there's another, yeah. another new number song. It's the number one song.
Okay.
Freddie Fender. Before the next teardrop falls. This is terrible. We looked this up. Remember we looked this up and we're like, who the hell is that? And Freddie Fender looks terrible.
Sort of do.
He looks just like, oh, like he's just.
Is he like black hair and chubby?
Yeah, real chubby and sweaty and like. Jeez. I don't know. He just like.
Freddie Fender. I'm trying to think if I knew that was a name. Is it in Spanish?
Yeah, part of it's in Spanish.
Well, get to the English part. I'm not going to know this part.
Maybe I found one that's all in Spanish. Hold on.
I don't recognize that song at all. It's awful.
Yeah, and then some of it in Spanish.
So part of the song is in Spanish?
Yeah, I guess. Let me see. It was written in 1967, and it's been recorded more than 24 times. The original version was by Duane D. and was on the country charts. Jerry Lee Lewis recorded one in 1969. And then in 1974, record producer Huey Mill approached Fender about overdubbing vocals for an instrumental track. Fender agreed, performing the song bilingual style, singing the first in English and then in Spanish. And it only took a few minutes, and he was just kind of messing around. He was just trying to get it over with. And then it immediately took off in popularity, then released to country radio in January of 75 and went to the number one spot on the Billboard charts in May. Why? I have no idea.
It's pretty shitty.
It doesn't sound good to me. I don't like it. But it doesn't mean it's not good. Okay, everybody?
It's not good. I'm pretty confident.
Well, Saturday, June 7th, you might change your tune when John Denver takes over the Billboard charts.
Oh, for about a week. Thank God I'm a Country Boy?
Yes.
Thank God I'm a Country Boy.
Is that all you know from it?
No, it's got something... Cakes on the griddle, life ain't nothing but a funny, funny riddle. Thank God I'm a country boy.
The song was written by John Martin Summers, a guitar, banjo, fiddle, mandolin player in Denver's backup band on December 31st, 1973, coincidentally Denver's 30th birthday, when he was driving from his home in Aspen, Colorado to L.A. The song is remarkably similar to a 1973 song by Arlo Guthrie from his album Last of the Brooklyn Cowboys entitled Uncle Jeff.
Really?
Yeah, apparently. I listened to it. Yeah, they both kind of sound, but all that stuff sounds to me that's
very similar
country type stuff. And then on June 14th, 1975, America takes over the number one spot.
With Horse with No Name?
Sister Golden Hair.
Oh, God, I do know that.
You do? I
don't know it by this name, though. Like, I know it. I know that song. But it doesn't say that hardly in it.
The lyrics were largely inspired by the works of Jackson Browne.
Yeah. Yeah, I know this one.
Yeah, you know the sound of it more than.
Thinking about you, Sister Golden Hair. That's where he says it.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's good. I don't know. Yeah. The video looked dumb, like crazy and weird in the 70s, I guess, but all the videos did then. But
Anyway,
I think that's a pretty good song, but that was the number one song then.
Okay.
And then on Friday, June 20th, 1975.
Yes.
You know, prior to 1975, summers were considered the graveyard season for movie releases.
Oh.
Did you know that? Like, they just didn't put out movies in the summers because it was like, nobody's.
They didn't put them out at all?
Yeah, I mean, They did, but nothing. Like, they didn't. There wasn't blockbuster. There was no summer blockbuster
right.
movies
no
until
such
1975.
Thing.
And over 67 million people in the U.S. went to see this film when it was initially released in 1975, making it the first summer blockbuster.
Yeah.
You know what it is?
Jaws.
Yep. Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss.
That's a good movie.
Yep. We watched that. We did watch this one. It is good. It does hold up. Robert Shaw and Richard Dreyfuss could not stand each other, and the two argued all the time. Did you know that?
Really?
And that resulted in some good tension between Hooper and Quint.
Yeah, it did.
Though respected as an actor, Robert Shaw's trouble with alcohol was a frequent source of tension during filming.
He kind of looked like...
You could tell he was an alcoholic. Like, he looked rough.
Yeah, he did.
In later interviews, Roy Scheider described his co-star as a perfect gentleman whenever he was sober. All he needed was one drink, and then he turned into a competitive son of a bitch.
Wow.
According to Carl Gottlieb's book, The Jaws Log, Shaw was having a drink between takes, at which one point he announced, "I wish I could quit drinking." Much to the surprise and horror of the crew, Richard Dreyfuss simply grabbed Shaw's glass and tossed it into the ocean.
Oh, man.
When it came time to shoot the infamous USS Indianapolis scene, Shaw attempted to do the monologue while intoxicated, as it called for the men to be drinking late at night. Nothing in the take could be used. A remorseful Shaw called Steven Spielberg late that night and asked if he could have another try. The next day of shooting, Shaw's electrifying performance was done in one take.
Oh,
that whole
wow.
monologue, remember that
yeah.
whole monologue?
Yeah, oh, I love that monologue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is all according to IMDb.
Wow.
And then according to writer Carl Gottlieb, the
three men went in. What did he say? Something like how many men went in?
I can't remember. Three, I don't remember. But according to Carl Gottlieb, the line, "You're going to need a bigger boat," was mm-hmm. not scripted.
Yeah, I heard that. I've heard that before.
Roy. And then I have one other funny thing. During pre-production, director Steven Spielberg, accompanied by friends Martin Scorsese, George Lucas, and John Milius,
mm-hmm.
visited the effect shop where Bruce the shark was being constructed. That's mm-hmm. what they called him, Bruce.
Yeah.
Lucas stuck his head in the shark's mouth to see how it worked. And as a joke, Milius and Spielberg snuck to the controls and made the jaw clamp shut on Lucas's head.
Oh, my God.
Unfortunately, and rather prophetically, considering the later technical difficulties the production would suffer, the shark malfunctioned, and Lucas got stuck in the mouth of the shark.
Oh, jeez.
Spielberg and Milius were finally able to free him. The three men ran out of the workshop afraid they'd done major damage to the creature.
Jeez.
And when the shark was built, it was never tested in the water. So when they put it in the water at Martha's Vineyard, it sank straight to the ocean floor and took a team of divers to retrieve it. How funny is that?
What in the world? Now, why wouldn't you test that before you put it in there?
Because it was the 70s, baby. Everybody was high.
That is so stupid.
Everyone was drunk and on drugs all the time. And this was a new thing. Like,
yeah.
Nobody did this before. Probably.
Yeah.
Now you don't even need to have a giant shark. It's all just CGI.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of sad. I wonder if that Meg movie was any good.
What movie?
The Meg.
The Meg?
It's supposed to be a shark the size of a house.
What? Are you thinking of Sharknado?
No, there's a movie that came out called The Meg, and it's a shark the size of like a house.
Are you saying M-E-G or M-A-G? Meg or Mag?
I'm not sure which one it is.
Oh.
But it's supposed to be like a dinosaur shark.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was like a big summer blockbuster, this, speaking of.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no...
Yeah, the kids at school are talking about it.
They were?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you shoved those kids at school. You have my permission to shove them. That was Jaws.
All right.
Any other questions about Jaws?
I just think it's a great horror movie. I think it really does create, like, I love the suspenseful parts and the music. And, like, when they're walking around the sides of that boat and you see it, like, brushing up against the sides of the boat and...
Yeah.
And
there's like nothing left of the boat and stuff.
Oh my God. And like you could just, when it was terrorizing them. And
I'm never going in the ocean again.
I mean, real sharks don't act like that, I don't
think.
Do.
Yep, they do. They all do. They're all evil dicks.
But
I don't know. I just, you know, I don't, my brother once said, I like my life enough to not need to risk it to enjoy things.
So you're not going to go in the ocean ever again?
Not very far. Just a little bit.
You're not going to snorkel again?
Nope. I don't want to do that. I have no...
Yeah.
As soon as I start snorkeling, all I think about is that that movie where they those people get left on the ocean forever.
Oh yeah.
Or like something crazy like that happening. I just can't stop thinking about that stuff, and I can make myself have a panic attack. So
yeah.
But to me, when you snorkel, I've snorkeled before and it's beautiful. It's neat to see the schools of fish and the coral and all that. But to me, seeing that in the water while I'm snorkeling looks exactly the same as looking at a picture, a Google image search of fish.
No.
Yeah, I don't see a difference.
Come on. Fine, I thought you were going to say at the zoo or something where I could say, okay, I can see that.
Nope.
But a picture.
The same as Google image search. There's no difference. So I'll gladly just stay on the boat and drink some beers with the guy singing about Jamaica.
All right, what else?
Anyway, sorry, that's not popular opinion. Saturday, June 21st, 1975, Captain and Tennille take over the number one spot on the Billboard charts.
Love will keep us together.
Yeah. You know this song was written by Neil Sedaka?
Was it?
And Howard Greenfield. And Sedaka recorded it himself in 1973.
Then it didn't do well, I guess.
He released it as a single in France.
Oh, okay.
But then Captain Tennille covered the song. With instrumental backing by L.A. session musicians from the Wrecking Crew, not to be confused with Dr. Dre's Wrecking Crew.
Oh, okay. Nobody would.
Because they were CRU, I think. Anyway.
I kind of like this song. It's real cheesy.
It is good. Yeah, I like it too. It's a cool groove.
Yeah.
But Captain, actually, somewhere in the middle of the song, you hear Tennille.
Mm-hmm.
She calls out Captain and says, "You're not even a real fucking captain." If you listen close, you can hear that.
Really?
She's like, "You're not even a real fucking captain, you bitch."
No.
Yeah.
You're making things up.
No, but he's not a real captain.
So none of that happened?
No, but his name is, do you know what his name is, what the captain's name is?
No.
I didn't know this, so I looked this song up for some reason. We talked about these guys. I don't know why I didn't. Daryl Dragon.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Good thing his first name's not Peter.
Peter Dragon?
Yeah.
Oh, like wieners?
Yeah.
Dragon has wiener?
Yeah.
Jeez. Oh, that's like dragon, like the animal. Like
I
the
know.
Mythical.
I know.
Oh. You always, you know, I'm clean and above board, and then you bring everything down to, you know, you're the reason my mom can't play our podcast for my grandma, because she says, yeah, I think grandma would like to hear you guys, but then there's just so much talking about sucking dicks. So I just don't know if grandma would like the dick sucking stuff. You guys always talk about dicks a lot. So I don't know.
We do.
So maybe we need to release a version where we just cut out the parts where you talk
about
dragon people's wieners.
It's not fun.
It's not fun, but it's awesome. Saturday, July 19th, 1975. The number one song on the Billboard chart is by Wings.
Ugh.
Listen to what the man says. Said. Listen to what the man said.
That
remember that
I don't
one?
Know.
Dave Mason and Joe English play on it, and Tom Scott plays soprano saxophone, and who cares, because Wings...
sucks.
The Wings suck.
Wings sucks.
Wings sucks. It's a terrible band, and it's awful.
Yep.
And then Monday, July 21st, 1975, according to the Almanac of the Infamous, the Incredible and the Ignored, by Juanita Rose Violini, on July 21st, 1975, the Liverpool Echo reported the details of a fatal coincidence in the streets of Hamilton, Bermuda.
Okay.
Listen to this. You're not going to believe this.
Okay.
You're going to think I made all this up.
Okay.
But that's why I just quoted where this is from. 1 year earlier than July 21st, 1975, so July 21st, 1974, a young man of 17... Neville Eben.
Mm-hmm.
See, I thought I had more info on this. Okay. 1 year earlier, a young man of 17, Neville Eben, he was 17 years old and he was riding his moped happily through the streets when he was knocked to the ground by a taxi cab and killed.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
Exactly 1 year to the day later.
Yeah.
Erskine Eben, his younger brother, who was only a year younger, who is now 17.
Yeah.
Was killed while riding the same bike.
Oh, my God.
In the same intersection by the same taxi driver.
Oh, no. You
wait,
didn't say that.
Carrying the same passenger.
What?
Yes. Yes.
No way.
According to their father, John Henry Eben of Woodlawn Roads.
Yeah.
He said, even the passenger in the taxis was the same in both instances.
Well, how could that be?
How fucked up is that?
It was a year later?
It was exactly on the same day. He was riding the same moped on the same intersection, and then got hit by the same taxi with the same driver and the same passenger.
Now, wouldn't you, there's a lot of questions I got going on here. Wouldn't you, first of all, sell that moped after your brother died on it?
You would think.
You would think, right?
And then no way would you ride it on the same day that he died.
Right.
Much less in the same
area.
But what do you think he was thinking when he saw that cab come? Like, holy
what?
What
do you think the cabbie thought?
He was like, what?
Jesus
again?
Christ, again.
I'm never going to ride it. It's the same guy as fucking brother.
Oh, not again. Oh, no.
So the only other thing I thought, maybe it's not that much of a coincidence. Maybe there's only like four people in the town.
Yeah.
Like maybe it's just the two brothers and their parent.
And then the cab driver and his passenger.
The cab driver and that one passenger. Like maybe that town only has five people in it.
Yeah.
So it's a good chance.
It's still not a good chance.
And maybe
chance.
He doesn't have brakes in his cab. And so the guy's like, I guess I'll take this taxi again. I got no other way to get around.
That's crazy.
Isn't that nuts?
Yes.
I'm sure if we really dug deep, there's probably something that says it's not exactly that didn't happen. But that's a crazy story.
That is a crazy story.
Yeah, I love that one. I couldn't wait to get to that one. And then that's it for our podcast. Let's jump the shark.
No, come on.
No more podcasts. Wednesday, July 23rd, 1975. Ryan's Hope was on.
Oh, Lord.
And so was a show called Tattletales.
Okay.
With three celebrity couples were panelists. Oh, we talked about that. And we talked about Ryan's Hope. Oh, no, this was a date from the previous episode, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, so sorry, I won't talk July 23rd. We'll skip that. Saturday, July 26, 1975, Van McCoy and the Soul City Symphony take over the Billboard number one spot.
Okay.
You know what they sang?
No.
The Hustle.
Oh, do the hustle. Do the hustle.
True or false, this song won the Grammy Award for Best Pop Instrumental Performance early in 1976 for songs recorded in 1975.
True.
Yep. True or false, while in New York City to make the album, McCoy composed a song after his music partner, Charles Kipps, watched patrons do a dance known as The Hustle in a nightclub called Adam's Apple.
True
or false. The sessions were done at New York's Media Sound Studio with pianist McCoy, bassist Gordon Edwards, drummer Steve Gadd, keyboardist Richard T., guitarist Eric Gale and John Tropia, and orchestra leader Gene Orloff.
False.
Nope, true.
Damn.
True or false.
All right, no more of that.
Every time I listen to this song,
yeah, how do you
I
feel?
Get a boner.
Probably true.
Hey, you know, I don't. True. Well, maybe it is. I don't know. I haven't listened to the song that much.
Chances are.
Can you do the hustle?
You will have one because you have one most of the day.
Hey, you don't. You know, this is a family podcast. This is a fucking family podcast.
All right.
Stop talking about my
what
wiener.
Did you ask me?
Do you know how to do the hustle?
I sort of.
Can you do it real quick?
No, I'm not doing
it
right
no,
now.
No, we'll do audio of you doing it.
No, we're not.
That's pretty good. Oh, good job.
I'm
that's
not
going to
do it.
Now do the hustle. I want to see what it is. I don't know what it is.
It's a line dance.
It is?
Yeah.
It's a line dance?
It's like a line dance.
You know, I have to say, I just can't get on board with line dancing. I don't really get it.
I think you can do it with a partner.
The hustle or
the
line
hustle,
dancing in general?
The hustle. But it's also a line dance. I've seen people do it with a partner, too. But okay. It's like the same steps.
But line dancing in general, like, what's your opinion on that? Do you participate? Or do you leave the dance floor?
I do sometimes. But nowadays, I wouldn't. But
I usually just leave the dance floor.
When I worked with the kids with Down syndrome, though, they were all about that.
They love
so
it. And
I
they're good at
it.
They know all the steps and everything.
Some of them.
And
well, I had one who knew all.
Clap your hands.
I had one who knew all of, along with Michael Jackson's entire repertoire.
Yeah. Michael Jackson's big in the
in the Down syndrome community.
Yeah,
that's right.
I've known several people with Down syndrome that can do all of his dance moves and really well.
I know.
But the only thing is they do them at usually inappropriate times.
Right.
<You know?
Yeah.
laughs> The other problem. A lot of times it would be like at the doctor's
blossom.
Office or
yeah.
Hey, meet your new nurse. Okay, here's the whole dance from the
Thriller
way you make me
whatever,
feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the only thing I do, I either leave the dance floor or I insist on doing the line dance at a wedding or something, but doing it wrong or doing it my own way.
Oh, on purpose.
On purpose, just to like
just to piss everybody off.
But what I found, what I do is the reading jogs your mind dance, which in Northwood, Ohio, we all had to learn reading jogs your mind during Right to Read Week every year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually the song you hear on our podcast when we intro to the 70s. You hear that little mm-hmm. 70s groove that we do. We're
That's
using
from
that.
Reading Jogs Your
yeah,
Mind?
Yeah, it's from
Jeez.
The recorded version of from Houghton Mifflin, the book company, textbook company.
How did you get
had
that?
Had a record. I knew people. I found it and recorded it. I got it from somebody who was a librarian at the elementary school. But anyway, every kid in Northwood for years, from the 70s, 80s, and everything, all did that every single year. We learned that dance. And so
we've all
got it memorized. Like every kid in Northwood can do it. Roll,
every
roll,
kid.
Roll,
and you
click,
do like a flash
click,
mob.
Step, kick, side, together, side, kick. I mean, everybody from Northwood knows it and can say it all. And
so
do
you
it.
Should do a flash mob.
We should.
Northwood
I mean,
flash mob, well, everybody we, doing that dance.
I'm telling you, we do it at every reunion. Somebody gets up and starts doing that, and then everybody gets up and starts doing the...
Really?
Reading, jogs your mind, side, yeah,
what, now, what
side,
did the whole
kick,
thing have
step,
to do with
kick.
Reading? Was there any reading involved
It was
all?
During Right to Read Week. So,
okay, so you were doing a dance.
Yeah, it was more like for exercise. It was like to get you up and moving, and then you'd read, and then I don't know. I don't really know, get it exactly.
It
they taught
do.
Us that, but we also did... square dancing. They taught us square
yeah,
dancing.
Yeah, we did that.
Which I just heard some story about why square dancing was in school.
What was it?
It has sinister...
Of course it does.
Some president instituted that to keep people racist or something. Or
to keep the black
like,
people from...
There's something about like, keeping...
Being able to groove it.
I can't remember. Like something about keeping weird country music in the... schools or something. I can't remember where I even saw that.
Well, this is a great reporting you've done here.
Yeah. Well, I just thought of it just now. I wasn't planning on bringing that up until we got to it. We kind of roundaboutly got to
yes.
it. But I'll look that up and report back next time. What,
okay.
Who, what, I, one president put that in the curriculum or something, and it was like a sinister reason, but I can't remember why. Like
It was because black people know how to dance too good, and
well,
they didn't want them to do their dance.
I think it was the thing they were afraid of white culture being erased eventually, which it really, some of it really should be.
Right.
Like Neil Sedaka. yeah, an hour to July 30th,
yes.
1975. I think you have a little something to share with us,
yeah.
don't you?
Okay, so I have to go back a little bit, as I sometimes do.
Okay.
James R. Hoffa was born in 1913.
Jimmy Hoffa?
Yes.
Oh.
And he demonstrated a natural ability to organize and lead in an early age. He rose quickly through the ranks of the Teamsters Union in the 1930s and 40s, helping to bring the local and regional unions together into a national organization. By 1957, Hoffa was president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, one of the most powerful labor unions in the United States.
The Teamsters. You don't mess with the Teamsters.
Hoffa didn't gain power and political muscle through grit alone. He was a friend of the working man, but he also made friends in organized crime as well.
Oh, you don't say.
During the early days of the Teamsters, Hoffa used mob muscle to win strikes and earn favorable contracts. In return, as the Teamsters grew, the mafia was free to draw loans out of the large Teamster pension funds. This unholy alliance led to heightened government scrutiny and high-profile federal investigations.
Oh, boy.
So in 1964, Hoffa was convicted of fraudulent use of the Teamsters pension fund and attempting to bribe a juror.
Bribery.
He appealed to the convictions, but went to jail in 1967 to serve a 13-year sentence. President Richard Nixon commuted Hoffa's sentence in 1971 in exchange for Teamster support in the 1972 election, which I think is shady in and of itself. Which,
yeah, that's shady as fuck, but not like Nixon wasn't
right.
shady as fuck.
Hoffa's freedom had a bigger price tag for him, banishment from union activity for 10 years. He tried unsuccessfully in court to remove the ban, and he also attempted to rally support among his union and mafia connections. Things had changed while Hoffa had been away, though. His replacement as president of the Teamsters, Frank Fitzsimmons, was considered by business and government as easier to work with than Hoffa. Mob connections liked Fitzsimmons in the top seat because he did not invite controversy, and he was reportedly more pliable than the bold, brash Hoffa. So Hoffa tried to rebuild his influence in the Teamsters from the ground up. In the process, he ran afoul of Anthony Provenzano, a Teamsters vice president from New Jersey, who also happened to be a major mafia figure.
And when you say run afoul.
So he got...
He butted heads with him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hoffa agreed to meet with Provenzano and another mafia leader, Anthony Giancarlo... No, Giacalone.
Giacalone.
To work out their problems. So, Anthony Provenzano used to be friends with Hoffa.
Okay.
But now they're enemies. And he had threatened to kidnap and hurt Hoffa's granddaughter.
Oh.
Hoffa called Provenzano crazy.
Mm-hmm.
In 1973 and 1974, Hoffa talked to him to ask for help in supporting him for his return to power. And Provenzano refused to listen and threatened Hoffa by saying he would pull out his guts and kidnap his granddaughters.
That's harsh.
Yeah. Hoffa could not afford to take the threats lightly.
I mean, you could just say no, not like, hey.
I know.
No, like, hey.
And
no,
on top
no,
of that.
No, I don't want these Girl Scout cookies. And if you ask me again, I'm going to rip out your guts and kill your granddaughter.
Right, exactly.
That's harsh.
But Hoffa knew that there was at least two of Provenzano's political opponents were believed to have been murdered. Others who had spoken out against him had been physically assaulted.
So you would think that would make him have caution, right?
Right.
And worry about, like, not maybe not meet with him?
Yeah. The threats from the mafia that they would get rid of Hoffa were taken very seriously. There had been three visits in a short time frame to Hoffa's home and one trip to the Guardian Building law offices by Anthony Giacalone, an alleged kingpin in the Detroit Mafia, and his younger brother Vito. Friendly with Provenzano and believed to be related to him, their avowed purpose in coming was to set up a peace meeting between Provenzano and Hoffa.
Mm.
Hoffa's son viewed the peace meeting overture as only a pretext. He was convinced that Giacalone was setting his dad up for a hit.
Oh.
Even yeah. Hoffa himself was becoming increasingly uneasy each time the Giacalones arrived.
Mm.
The meeting would take place at the Macus Red Fox. M-A-C-H-U-S. Is that how you would say that?
Macus? Macus? I have no idea.
Okay. A suburban Detroit restaurant.
Machus?
So then
Machu, M-A-C-H-U, Machu?
I don't know.
Machus?
So now we're at July 30th, 1975.
Oh, so this is the last time he was seen, right? So this was the same time. If he would have just...
Well, I haven't gotten there yet. He's not disappeared yet.
Right, but if he would have, he was about to meet these...
About to meet him, that's
these
right.
These Gambinos, is that what you say?
Giacalone.
Is it Gambino? Is that a bad word? Is that like a
mafia
guy? Like, he's about to meet these guys who have killed other people and disappeared them, have made people disappear. But if he would have just stayed home and watched Celebrity Bowling, which was on with starring Jed Allen, Ed Ames, and Joseph Campanella. You know who those guys are?
I don't know any.
You do. Joseph Campanella is this guy. Like, if you Google all three of these.
Yeah.
Or IMDb them, you will know him. Joseph Campanella is known for, he's been in everything. But he's on One Day at a Time. He played Ed Cooper, and he was on Mannix and Hangar 18.
Okay.
Ed Ames, I don't really know, but the other guy, Jed Allen, he was from Days of Our Lives. You knew him as the, I think he played like Mickey or somebody.
I don't watch Days of Our Lives.
If you watch Days of Our Lives, he was on soap operas and stuff.
Okay. So they were all three bowling
like
together.
B-level celebrities.
Yes.
Yeah, they were bowling on Celebrity Bowling.
Okay.
And the Jed Stafford show, the Jim Stafford variety show was on. It was a country music guy who sang Spiders and Snakes and Swamp Witch. He had a dumb show.
Okay.
Anyway.
And
he
could have
stayed home and watched those shows.
Yep.
Celebrity Bowling instead.
He left home in his green Pontiac Grandville at 1:15 p.m.
He's probably like, it'll be real quick, and I'll get home in time for Celebrity Bowling. Everything will be great.
Before heading to the restaurant, he stopped in Pontiac to talk to his close friend, Louis Linto.
Oh, boy.
Linto and Hoffa used to be enemies, but had since mended their differences, and by the time Hoffa left prison, Linto became his unofficial appointment secretary.
Oh.
It was well known in both underworld and labor union circles that Linto acted as a buffer for Hoffa.
Okay.
And that if anyone needed a face-to-face meeting with him, they needed to contact Linto first.
Okay.
So,
but Linto saw him, and it was the last one to see him alive. Is that right? Is that right?
Right.
Louis
so,
Linto.
At 2:15 p.m., then Hoffa calls his wife because he's annoyed because these guys aren't there yet.
Hey, where are these guys? Where are these Goombas?
Yep. So he...
Forget about it.
He complained, where the hell is Tony Giacalone? I'm being stood up.
Where the hell is this guy? I'm picturing Joe Pesci. Didn't he play him in a movie or something?
No, Jack Nicholson played him in the movie.
Oh, he did?
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Hoffa?
His wife told him she hadn't heard from anyone. He told her he would be home at 4 p.m. Several eyewitnesses saw Hoffa standing by his car and pacing the restaurant's parking lot.
I'll be home at 4 p.m. just in time for celebrity bowling. Does that sound like Jack Nicholson? No, it
not at all. Two men saw Hoffa emerge from the Red Fox after a long lunch and recognized him. They stopped to chat with him briefly and to shake his hand. At 3:27 p.m., Hoffa called Linto, complaining that Gia Colon was late. That dirty son of a bitch, Tony Jock, set this meeting up, and he's half an hour late, Hoffa said. Linto
Forget
told
about
him
it.
To calm down and to stop by his office on the way home. Hoffa said he would and hung up. At 7 a.m. the next morning, Hoffa's wife called her son and daughter by telephone saying that their father had not come home.
Oh, even though they were late.
Yep.
He never came home.
On his way to the house, Hoffa's daughter, on her way to the house, Hoffa's daughter claimed to have had a vision of her father, who she was already sure was dead. He was slumped over wearing a dark-colored short-sleeve polo shirt, is what she says.
You said a vision in her mind?
Yeah, that's what she says.
Oh, maybe she's got magical powers. Maybe she's a wizard.
Right. I think that's what we're supposed to believe.
Maybe she can animate a half-eaten bag of Funyuns.
At 7:20 a.m., Linto went to the Machus Red Fox and found
Machus.
Hoffa's unlocked car in the parking lot, but there was no sign of Hoffa or any indication of what happened to him.
Wait, his car was there?
Yes.
It was just there,
and
empty.
Unlocked.
Mm-hmm. Unlocked.
He called the police, who later arrived at the scene.
State
police were brought in, and the FBI were alerted. At supper time, Hoffa's son, James P. Hoffa, filed a missing persons report. I don't know why his wife didn't do it.
Maybe she, you know, who knows? Everything else we're talking about, maybe back then women weren't allowed to.
It's probably true. Years of extensive investigation involving numerous law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, came to no definite conclusion. Gia Colon and Provenzano, who denied having scheduled a meeting with Hoffa, were found not to have been near the restaurant that afternoon. Hoffa was declared legally dead on July 30th, 1982.
Oh, they actually found him and declared him dead in 1982, the same
day?
Nope,
they didn't find him.
Oh, they didn't, but they declared him dead the same day Lewis and Clark was aired. It was a sitcom on NBC starring Gabe Kaplan. For a naive New Yorker, Stuart Lewis, Gabe Kaplan, has a strange, some would say twisted, ambition. He wants to own a country music club. His wife and kids hate the idea. Despite their misgivings, Stuart moves his family to Luckenbach, Texas, where he bought the Nassau County Cafe, a joint that has had 9 owners in the last 6 years and sports a sign that says, always under new management, while his sidekick, Roscoe Clark, played by Gooch Kook, stands by. Stuart lets fly one-liners and bad puns. His sidekick was Gooch Kook. Okay. That was the actor that played him. But anyway, the series featured an episode with guest appearance by the guy who played Epstein from Welcome Back, Kotter, and the guy who played Freddie Boom Boom Washington. They had like guest spots on the show. But it was Welcome Back, Kotter's new show.
All right.
It's called Lewis and Clark.
So here, my last little part of this is
The same time this happened. What happened while Lewis and Clark was on?
Well, this is the theories. I'm going to just quickly go into some theories of what people think happened.
Wait, but you didn't explain why was he declared dead?
Because think about it. It was exactly to the day.
Yeah.
What was that?
5 years?
15 years. It was 85?
82. 7 years later?
7 years to the day.
Yeah.
So
they just gave up?
You can declare somebody legally dead.
If there's no sign of him or any progress.
Yeah, right.
Okay. I thought they were like something.
But that way, because his wife wouldn't have been able to get any death benefits until he's declared dead.
So she had to wait 7 years.
She had to wait 7 years, yeah.
Oh, and by that time, she was already dating a new fella named Mark.
Your glasses are like high up on your your eyes look like you got four eyes.
Well, maybe I do have four eyes.
You
she was dating a guy
eyes.
Named Mark anyway, and he worked at Food Town in the produce section.
So here's
Mark
one theory. One theory was Jimmy Hoffa was shot, dismembered, frozen, and then buried in the cement at the old Giants Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey.
Yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that.
Specifically, Hoffa was buried under Section 107.
107.
When the stadium was demolished in 2010, so convinced was the FBI the story was bunk that the agency didn't even bother to search the site.
What? They didn't even look?
Nope, didn't even look.
Shit.
Another
Somebody
theory
did.
Is that Hoffa was crushed by a 40 cubic yard trash compactor outside the Raleigh House restaurant in the Detroit suburbs, 5 miles from where he vanished. The mafia famously ran the sanitation business, so it was a relatively routine hit.
Yeah, it's easy to get rid of them.
Theory number three, according to Joseph Franco, Hoffa's former associate and Hoffa's former associate and self-proclaimed thief, extortionist, leg breaker, and hired killer, Hoffa was shoved alive out of an airplane over one of the Great Lakes by a couple of federal agents.
Oh, really? Federal agents. Hired goons.
Hired goons.
Hired goons.
Before his death, mobster and former friend of Hoffa, Frank the Irishman Sheeran, confessed to the hit.
Ed Sheeran's
dad. And said that Jimmy was shot to death and then cremated in a trash incinerator in the Detroit suburbs.
That's probably right.
Interestingly enough, Sheeran was portrayed by Robert De Niro in an upcoming Netflix original movie based on Sheeran's account of the Hoffa murder. Al Pacino will be playing Hoffa.
Oh, and we'll take these. We'll take the advertising dollars for plugging
that. That's right.
So now you guys, that show will be super successful because people heard about it on American Timeline, the greatest podcast in the world.
Hoffa was shot with a stun gun was another theory. It ground up at an ironworks, placed in a steel drum, and shipped to the Everglades where his remains were dispersed. Some accounts note that he may have been partially digested by alligators. Notice a trend in these theories.
They're just crazier and crazier.
They keep
jumping the shark. Theories are jumping the shark.
Theory number six. According to mafia chauffeur turned stool pigeon Marvin Elkind, Hoffa was kidnapped, killed, and then buried in the wet concrete foundation of Detroit's Renaissance Center. Elkin noted ominously to the New York Post in 2011, practically every union carpenter in and around the city was called in to rush the construction of wooden forms needed for pouring concrete at the Renaissance Project.
Forget about it. What's a stool pigeon?
What?
What's a stool pigeon?
I think it's somebody who
snitches.
Poop?
Oh.
I think.
Stool pigeon?
Or I don't know.
Does that have to do with stool and poop?
All right, and then
I have a question though. Well, okay. Well, you finish up, and then I'll ask.
All right, number seven. Hoffa was stabbed in the head with a hunting knife, placed in a steel drum, set on fire, buried, then dug up and compacted inside a car and shipped to Japan as recycled scrap metal for use in new cars.
Yeah.
An investigative reporter Jerry Stanecki noted in the New York Times, it was the ultimate insult, a non-union market.
Huh. That would just like piss him off, like just to dig into him.
And those are just the most popular theories surrounding the Jimmy
Hoffa.
There's
like hundreds of more.
Of course, none of these stories have amounted to anything, leaving the mystery unsolved. The official FBI report on the Jimmy Hoffa case, the so-called Hoffex memo, suggests a motive but not a method. According to the Chicago Tribune, quote, the memo says a plan was conceived in New Jersey by Teamsters with ties to the mafia to stage a hit on Hoffa in Detroit. According to federal authorities, the hit was set up out of fear of Hoffa's possible return to power in the Teamsters. Specifically, the memo suggests that Hoffa was killed so he wouldn't once again gain control of the shady Teamsters' central state pension fund, which was worth around $1 billion unadjusted for inflation.
Yeah, so the people in charge of that in the power, they're the ones who want him dead.
Yes. Hoffa's son, James P. Hoffa, elected head of the Teamsters in 1999, agreed that the mafia was involved and even ran his campaigns on the back of that conviction. The mob killed my father. If you vote for me, they will never come back, he told a crowd of truck drivers in 1996, which is pretty, that's so stupid.
Can you imagine the smell of a crowd of truck drivers?
But imagine
no offense to truck drivers.
Isn't that the stupidest campaign slogan?
That he was going to get rid of the mafia?
The mob killed my father. If you vote for me, they will never come back.
Yeah, he'll get rid of the mafia.
What he's really doing is name dropping his father.
Well, yeah, but
you know, vote for me because I'm Jimmy Hoffa's son.
Yeah, well, yeah, but he's also not giving any methods how he's going to get rid of the mafia.
No.
Did he win?
Yes.
Oh, he did?
Yes, well, he was elected head in 1999.
Well, if there's one thing that's true, it's elections are all, like, idiots will vote for anything.
But even if most people agree that the mob was responsible, there remains the continued fascination with the whereabouts of Hoffa's body more than 40 years later. As NPR's Alan Greenblatt suggested in 2013, that fascination is instinctual. Everyone knows we all must die, but people who go missing entirely tap into primal fears.
So, like, here's my question. Like, why? Surely there's been tons of mafia hits and people disappeared and died.
Right.
That's what they do. The mafia does that.
Yeah.
They kill people, they bury them, they put them places.
Yeah.
Why does everybody care so much about Jimmy Hoffa and not all the other ones?
Well, because he was the head of the Teamsters, I guess.
Because he was more famous or people knew him more.
Yeah,
like everyday
I guess.
People knew him, but
I mean, that's a good question.
I just didn't know like what made him stand out compared to
all the other people that have disappeared. Well, I don't think any big mob bosses have disappeared like that. I think like lower guys.
Yeah.
disappear, but like any of the big giant mob bosses, I don't think any of them have ever gone disappeared like that.
But you think like back then in the 70s, like everybody knew who Jimmy Hoffa was, like
across
the country?
I think so. He was in politics and stuff.
Oh, so I guess that's why. I just always wondered, like,
I mean, if Nixon commutes his sentence in exchange for having the Teamsters support him for re-election.
Okay, so I guess people know Joe Arpaio and all those mafia people Trump has.
Or
all the people Trump has pardoned or whatever. But all right, so that's fair enough.
Fair enough. Was it all right?
I don't know. At least it's not. There's no rapes.
No. Not that we know of.
Yeah, not that we know of. We'll pick up in August next episode, but I think that's about it for.
Okay.
But that's all the time we have for episode 41, and that's interesting. I never knew that much about Jimmy Hoffa or who he really was, so that's why I want to know more. So thanks for enlightening me on that.
Sure thing.
I didn't really get who he was, but we'll never. One thing is certain: we'll never know what happened to Jimmy Hoffa.
I don't think.
Oh, wait, there he is. Hey, Jimmy. Jimmy Hoffa's here.
Well, and I think that was another thing that that I was just gonna say. I think a lot of, there was rumors that he was still alive for a long time after that, I think. Like Elvis and stuff.
Sure.
And
maybe Elvis and Tupac and Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy Hoffa are
all
in a bar.
In some island somewhere.
Yeah. Islands in the stream.
And that's what that song's about.
Yeah. And Randy Savage.
He
didn't really die, I wish.
That's
are we just talking about people we wish didn't
no,
die?
No, that's not what we're talking about. All right.
There's
you're,
so many wrestlers.
You're hungover.
See, the thing I don't get is, like, there's so many wrestlers that have died young, but Jake the Snake Roberts is still alive somehow, and he was did, like, so many drugs.
All right. You're hungover today.
You're hungover.
No, I'm not.
Well, Drew Conley is responsible for me being hungover.
Yeah.
Drew Conley, friend of the show, Irish guy. American! Giant Irish guy.
He's not friend of the show. He doesn't even listen.
Yeah, he doesn't listen.
All right. Let's sign off.
Anyway, oh, there's Jimmy Hoffa. He's with Chuck Berry.
Oh,
in the
no.
bathroom.
Get out of here, Chuck Berry.
Guys, get out of here, Chuck Berry and Jimmy Hoffa. It's time to end this show.
Thanks for listening.
And download Matt Truman Ego Trip's music on Bandcamp. Pay for it because he deserves it and he's awesome. His music is really good. So he plays the beginning and he plays the end. He plays our American Timeline songs.
Yes, he rocks.
Buy his albums. And send us your teeth.
All right.
I love you guys.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.